It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Common Core state standards are benchmarks for learning that a lot of public school districts and some private schools across the country have adopted. Recent scrutiny of those standards has raised a flood of complaints.
In the last part of our series on Common Core, Kristen Durst takes a closer look at the controversy.
The Common Core state standards were developed by teachers, school administrators, and other education experts in an effort coordinated by state school commissioners and governors around the country. The idea behind the standards was to both raise the bar nationwide and to make education around the U.S. more consistent, so that a student who moves to another state or even just to a neighboring school can more easily pick up where they left off. But Common Core has hit a snag in some states. While the federal government didn't have a hand in developing the standards, the Obama administration supports them and even encouraged states to adopt them. That led to the standards being dubbed Obama Core by some Tea Party Republicans. Controversy ensued. At a hearing on Common Core in Wausau late last month, Joyce Bant of Hazelhurst said that the Common Core allows the federal government to dictate how to run your school and how to teach your kids.
Common Core is just that, an unconstitutional federal education policy that is a disaster waiting to happen.
That's one of the main complaints about the standards, that they amount to federal intrusion and take away local control. But Emily Amundson, the director of the Common Core state standards team at DPI, says the state chose the shared standards, and she says it's local districts that decide the curriculum.
Here in Wisconsin, we're a local control state. And what that means is that every individual local school district is charged with developing the curriculum, choosing the textbooks, the instructional strategies that are used. Those are all local decisions.
And as a local control state, school districts in Wisconsin technically wouldn't have to adopt the standards, or they could drop them altogether. However, that's unlikely because schools are still required to take annual state assessments. And starting next year, Wisconsin will switch to new computer-based standardized tests that are aligned to the Common Core. The ACT college and career exams, which will be required for high schoolers starting next year, will also be Common Core-based. And it's those assessments and high-stakes assessments in general, plus all the money that's being spent on Common Core, that has rankled some on the left. Tim Sleeker is the dean of education at Edgewood College, a private Catholic college in Madison.
Some people like me are concerned that the costs of implementing computer-based driven assessments are going to far exceed the benefits that can be given to students.
He says there's a lot of money nationwide flowing into what he says is now a Common Core industry that's selling schools all the things that they need to implement the standards. And Sleeker believes there are better uses for all of that money and better ways to address the achievement gap that exists among students of different racial and economic backgrounds.
The biggest challenge to student achievement is whether or not children are living in poverty, hunger, homelessness, health care, and then lack of access to books. Instead, we've spent a ton of time and money developing standards.
But supporters argue that the Common Core state standards are a worthy investment, an investment they say that gives kids a clear pathway to college and career and out of poverty. Kristen Durst, Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed the rest of the Common Core news series, catch up at WPR.org/news. In Wisconsin, there's a growing police practice of recording and collecting images of license plates. These images are taken by scanners mounted on police cars. They can record the date, time, and location of every passing vehicle.
But new legislation could soon change the way police departments handle these images and determine how long the images can be kept on file. And we'd love to hear from you on this. Do you think the scanning technology is necessary to police to do their jobs, or do you see it as a privacy violation? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or tell us what you think on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Chris Amity, Executive Director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, and good afternoon to your listeners around Wisconsin.
So do you know how widespread this license plate scanning is here in Wisconsin?
We don't know exactly how widespread the practice here is in Wisconsin, but it's certainly growing. Since 2010, numerous law enforcement agencies have adopted it or have expressed an interest in it. And, of course, Milwaukee was one of the ones that adopted it early on. But it's not just a Milwaukee issue. For instance, there's police agencies in Dane County that use it. And as of last summer, 29 agencies around the state had expressed an interest in using this. And this is one of those things that I think has a sort of a bandwagon effect. You know, police managers go to conventions. They talk to salesmen who are pushing this kind of technology, as well as all sorts of other technology. And it starts getting rolled out without adequate thought about how to implement the use of these readers in terms of privacy and other important civil liberties issues.
Well, as far as the function of these, it kind of makes sense. Police have said, you know, we can use these to catch hit-and-run drivers. If there's an amber alert, it's useful for us to be able to search a database of when and where a license plate might have been. In principle, before we get to the longer-term storage of these images, in principle, is there anything wrong with having these things on the streets?
Yes, there is. The ACLU believes that license plate readers do have legitimate purposes and can be used for criminal detection purposes or criminal investigations, but there really should be reasonable suspicion that a crime has occurred before examining all the collected license plate images that police have. And now that, you know, millions and millions of images are being collected and have already been collected in Wisconsin, and a lot of that data is on innocent people, people who have done nothing more than drive down the road, because it's possible to set up your squad car and your automated license plate reader and capture the license plate, including the time, location markers, for every car that goes by. So the trick is to collect the information and then use it to match it against hot lists of stolen cars or suspects in criminal investigations. But don't use it to create dossiers about the goings-on of innocent Americans.
So right now, is there any kind of regulation or guidance on what happens with these images, how long they're kept, how they're used?
Well, that has to be worked out. As of last summer, five states had regulation of license plate readers in their statutes. And now, of course, this bill has been introduced in the Wisconsin legislature by Representatives Craig and Kessler, and the ACLU supports that, because before we get too far into this, you really do need to give it some thought. You know, just like the NSA surveillance of innocent Americans' phone conversations, you know, that grew and grew and grew without any real thought, technology, whether it's automated license plate readers, unmanned aerial vehicles, concentrated networks of CCTV cameras like in La Crosse, they just tend to grow because you can do it. And its capability runs these things rather than finding out how best to use them for legitimate law enforcement purposes so that you can protect civil liberties and privacy.
So in that new legislation, is there guidance on how long you can keep these images around?
Right. They're going to, it's my understanding that the legislation would require destruction of data within 48 hours unless it matches a hot list to identify information that's relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. And so that's certainly something that the ACLU wants to see. The ACLU put out a report in July of 2013 called You Are Being Tracked, How License Plate Readers Are Being Used to Record Americans' Movement. And people can go to the National ACLU website to access the whole report. In that report, we make a number of recommendations about when to use the technology, how long things should be retained, what about sharing. And another important thing for the legislation that's under consideration now by the Wisconsin legislature is to make sure that it's not shared in inappropriate ways.
So could an appropriate way be the police in this county or this municipality can share with other police agencies in the state? Would that be okay, do you think?
I think that's fine if it's limited to hits or images that connect to a relevant ongoing criminal investigation. They shouldn't be able to go on fishing expeditions and just sort of throw it all through the Wisconsin Statewide Information Center or some other network that's available here. And it's important to understand that Wisconsin law enforcement is already sharing information through the Statewide Data Fusion Center and other systems like that. And the ACLU, you know, recognizes that a lot of these individual technologies like automated license plate readers or unmanned aerial vehicles or whatever can have legitimate purposes. So, you know, we're not opposed to the technology in and of itself, but what particularly scares us, and I think it's not overblown to say scares us, but I hope people won't think less of us for being scared about the loss of our privacy in this way. What really is an issue is how are they used in networks of surveillance? You know, if you look at, for instance, what's being developed here in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Police Department, of course, they've got automated license plate recognition systems, and they're taking millions of images. They're making hundreds of thousands of officer-initiated stops that are recorded. They're increasingly using CCTV cameras. They've got all kinds of other technologies. And when you put all that together, you can, unless there's proper oversight and proper regulation, create individual dossiers on innocent Americans, and we don't think that's right at the ACLU. And I suspect that there are many people on both sides of the political spectrum that agree with us. You know, the sponsors of this bill, Representative Craig and Representative Kessler, for instance, probably don't see eye to eye on a lot of different things, but one's a Republican, one's a Democrat, but they can agree here that we have to be very careful about implementing this and need some regulation instead of just saying, you can do it, go right ahead.
Police would say, hey, we're not going to create these dossiers. We just want this database for if a license plate comes up with a crime, and then we need to mine this data we've collected. Is that so wrong?
Well, mining data and just matching it against hot lists are two different things. I think what would be a good idea here is, you know, if we're going to have a system, how do you have oversight? If I go back to my example of the National Security Agency and all their telephone intercepts, the court that was supposed to do that oversight was just incapable of doing it. I think it would be a good idea, and in the ACLU report that people can find online, this is among our recommendations, let's have a little self-help when it comes to oversight. Let's make it required that individuals can ask whether or not their record or a record of a hit on their a license plate is in the database. People should have access to see if they're in the database and how information about them is being used, because obviously you can't get information about a criminal investigation, but here we've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of Wisconsinites who are having information that's going to be put into these databases when they haven't done anything wrong. They've just driven down the street.
Chris, thanks a lot for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Chris Amity is the executive director of the ACLU in Wisconsin. Thanks, Kristen. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at the origins of the fracking industry and how it's affecting the lives of millions here in the Midwest.
First, when was the last time you sat down and penned a letter to a friend or a family member, maybe a pen pal halfway around the world? In the age of texting, tweeting, and email, letter writing is becoming less and less common.
But our next guest won't be swayed that way, and he's written a new book championing the letter as a form of communication, and he wants you to put down the iPhone and pick up the pen and paper once in a while.
Simon Garfield is the author of many books, including his latest, To the Letter, a celebration of the lost art of letter writing. Simon, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Really nice to be with you.
So you've tackled subjects near and dear to my heart. Recent books, I talked to you about maps a while back, fonts. Now you've done it again with letter writing. What got you started on thinking about letters?
Well, it's an odd thing, really, because it forms, I mean, you mentioned the other two books, and it does form the final book in a sort of accidental trilogy, in a way. So that all these books are concern things that have been radically shaken up by the digital age. You know, typefaces, obviously, maps as well, and now letters. But I think this is the only one without a happy ending, for me, anyway. It was really sparked when I read that more and more people were sending condolence letters, you know, notes of sympathy by email and text as well. I haven't heard of one by tweet, but that's probably just around the corner. And I thought, okay, well, you know, if you're sending condolence letters by text, then we've reached a pretty path, and it's probably time to kind of look back at and celebrate great letters and great letter writers, but also to question, well, are we really happy to abandon, you know, this great thing we've been communicating by letter for 2,000 years, and we're about to kind of throw it away without, I imagine, much, you know, too much thought, really. It's just, it's happened. It began, as we know, probably with the telephone, gradually, and then, especially over the last 10, 15 years or so, when obviously everyone's on email, we find that no one writes letters anymore. And the book really, you know, is concerned with how we're going to document our future history without letters.
And you're unabashedly pro-letter. You even write about loving the smell of them and the feel of them and the sort of whoosh
well,
that they make.
I mean, you make me sound very
romantic,
obsessional, Veronica. And that's not the idea. But no, I certainly love the feel of them, and I think that's something that we're sort of already beginning to miss, you know. I don't want to sound at all that I'm anti-email or text, and I kind of tweet as well, and obviously I use email as much as anyone else, and I couldn't have written the book because I interview a lot of people. I couldn't have contacted them so, you know, efficiently and quickly without email. So I'm not anti that at all. I'm just aware that, you know, we have a lot to lose. And
let's talk about that. I mean, obviously we have a lot of convenience when we use email and text, but what do we lose when we give up the letter?
Well, I think we lose a certain depth of writing, and I don't think we write with the same sort of emotion as we do when we send emails. You know, even before, you know, the Edward Snowden news and the NSA and before it was clear that, you know, more people than just the recipient were reading our emails. I kind of felt uneasy about sort of, you know, expressing any great emotion or intimacy on a keyboard. There was just something kind of not quite right about it for me. So I think we don't write the same way. We also kind of, I think we write letters in a more thoughtful way. It's more of an effort and more of a process. You know, we sit down, we have an envelope at the ready, hopefully a postage stamp at the ready, and we think about things in a kind of longer form, you know, so not just instant responses as we would do, you know, in the digital way, but we would try and analyze things. Maybe we'll condense a week's news into a letter of a couple of weeks' news. And obviously the personal touch as well, you know, the handwriting and the kind of crossings out, all that character we're I was going to say gradually beginning to lose, but I think we're losing it very fast.
So do we get so much more thoughtful in a letter? Does it make that much difference in a letter? Can't we do that on email?
Well, no, I think we do write in another way. And I think the real problem with, I mean, emails are fantastic in so many ways. You know, as I've mentioned, efficiency and the way they're so instant and the way they're obviously cheap.
But I think because of that, we sort of tend to treat them the way we might do, you know, like a post-it note almost. You know, it's often a sort of jotting more than necessarily a very thoughtful response. Now, obviously, there are massive amounts of exceptions to this, and I'm talking in a sort of general sense. But I know that if I sit down to write a letter, I would certainly do it in a more sort of composed way. I talk in the book of how if we write a letter, we commit a sort of a slower cerebral whirring, and I think that's right. I think our hand, and even if we type, I think we do it at a different speed. And
we're talking to Simon Garfield. His new book is To the Letter. It's about the lost art of letter writing. Want to hear from you. Do you still write letters? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll get to your calls coming up in just a few minutes. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Simon Garfield, author of the new book, To the Letter, about the lost art of letter writing. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We're wondering, do you still write letters? Do you like to revisit past letters every now again? Do you have precious letters that you've saved over the years? Our number, 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Colin with us in La Crosse. Colin, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that as a younger person, I'm 22, I don't recall a time when letter writing was really that common, that I grew up with email as the main way to get your information across. But I think it makes letters that much more special, that we've actually gained something on the letter writing front by making them a rare and special thing.
So do you sometimes write or receive that rare and special letter?
Yeah, there's a few that stand out in my mind. Had a couple of years ago, a friend from Las Vegas sent me a letter, and I still have it somewhere. I can't say exactly where since I've moved since then, but I know it's filed away in a drawer, and it'll, you know, pop up and make my day sometime when I'm digging through for it.
Colin, thank you so much for calling and sharing that. And Simon, that idea of saving letters, and a lot of people used to do this, some still do. Is that, I mean, we delete the old email, but we save the letter.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, obviously now it's a lot easier to save emails as well. You know, hopefully, you know, you've backed things up and things are on the cloud and all of that. But I think the real question is kind of what you save. And as your caller just said, the nice thing is if you receive a letter that really touches your heart, it becomes part of your possessions in a way that emails never can. And he's, you know, as Colin said, you kind of open them up sometimes, you know, when maps, if you want a special kind of boost, or if you're feeling down or whatever. Well, whatever it is, you know, you kind of think, oh, I've got this, and it cheers you up. I mean, I think it's interesting that he says that, you know, it's they're special now because they're quite rare. So if you do receive one, and I know this is true for me, you know, my heart just sort of jumps a bit if I get a nice handwritten letter, partly because I know it's not a demand for money, but also partly because you think someone has taken the care. You know, it used to be every day, and now it's a commitment. You have to get a postage stamp and an envelope, and you know the whole thing, catch the last post. And so, you know, it's a lovely kind of treat to have now.
Simon, I know as part of your research, you read lots of letters through the ages, and you came across some ones that were pretty special and stood out. Could you tell us about some of your favorite letters and letter writers?
Well, gosh, I mean, a huge list. We could be here till Friday, but I was quite fortunate in a way that, you know, I said to myself at the beginning, the great thing about the book that I wanted to write was really say I liberate letters, but be quite selective. So although I do try and cover the history of letter writing, I was just determined to pick up the ones that I really loved. So I think the first one that I think is extraordinary, the earliest one that I think is extraordinary, is a letter that Pliny the Elder wrote, Pliny the Younger, wrote about the eruption of Vesuvius. And it's the only written account that we have of the eruption, and obviously fantastically important event. And without that letter, we wouldn't have any details at all. And then, I don't know, we jump 1,800 years or so, and I love John Keats's letters, as you might expect from a poet. He wrote in a very lyrical way, often wrote about his poetry, about his thoughts about the world, and as we know, died fantastically young. So there's an extra kind of pathos when he's writing to his girlfriend Fanny Braun from Italy. He's gone to Italy because he's dying, and he's been advised by doctors that's the best chance for him in the Italian air, he writes extraordinary things. But I think my favourite set is a correspondence between two unknown people. I was very lucky to find this not long actually before I was due to hand the book in. A wonderful correspondence during the Second World War between a postman stationed in Greece and North Africa and his a friend of his in London as the bombs were about to fall. And the friend he writes to, and he writes just because he's bored, really on the off chance, he knew a little bit through work, but through their letters they fall in love. And it's a fantastic thing. So I thread the letters through the book, and it's a fantastic thing to read. And then it has a happy ending, and we know this because the letters were obtained from their two children. So an extraordinary thing, and I think it emphasizes the fact that letters are so much part of ordinary people's lives as well as obviously well-known people's lives as well.
I loved reading the Chris and Bessie stories. It was hard to not keep skipping ahead to see where their story went. Those were wonderful. Well, we've got more callers on the line. We've got Jeannie with us in Appleton. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I just listening to your guest, I wonder if part of letter writing goes with being English, because I am always also English, and I grew up writing letters to everybody, and I still like to write. I write a column for the local paper occasionally, but the thing I would like to say is that I think that it's far more important to the older generation. And my husband died about 3 years ago, and every time I would go out to the mailbox and come back in the last couple of years of his life, he'd say, "Is there any mail?" And I'd say, "No, nothing but junk." And he was always disappointed. And so when his birthday or Christmas was coming up, we could get cards at Christmas, sometimes with letters. When his birthday came up, I always asked my kids, please mail him a birthday card. Mm. Don't just bring it when you come over. He just loves to get mail. And so they did that sometimes, but they looked at me as if I was maybe crazy. But I still enjoy writing. If I had anybody left, and I am old now, if I had anybody left to write to, I would. But except for notes when somebody dies, I always write a personal note, or when somebody's ill. Nobody seems really to want letters anymore.
All right, Jeannie, I'm going to give you somebody to write to. Write us a letter, and we'll send that invitation to everybody out there. If you want to get some practice, not too much pressure, write us a letter. Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm giving you the address now. Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison, WI, 53706.
And we will read some of what we get on the air. If we get some letters, we'll share them with you too. And let's go next to, Simon, let's have you comment a little about, Jeannie made a beautiful comment about how much letters meant to her husband and now to her, and just something about getting them in the mail was special. Does that resonate with you?
Absolutely. Impossible to say quite what that is. What, precisely, how to define that sort of thrill, But there is a difference between receiving something through the postal system and having a postal worker deliver it through your door rather than someone turning up with it. But I think it goes back, I think, to the same thrill that one gets from just having a physical letter at all. I'm not quite sure. I would love, of course, to say, oh, yes, only the English write fantastic letters. But I can't support that one in my book. I have lots of lovely kind of, French and obviously American letters as well. So it shows a certain amount. I mean, this might be an awful thing to say. It shows a certain amount of sort of good breeding, I suppose. Now, if you encourage your children to write letters, that's sort of and you write letters yourself. That's the only way they'll know. Because as your first caller said, if you don't grow up with that around you, then why on earth should you sort of go to the effort of writing a letter.
So something I think pass on to the next generation.
Yeah, that's why we can only encourage by kind of sharing the way ourselves, I think.
We're talking with Simon Garfield about letter writing, and there's still time for you to join the conversation. What letters are special to you? Have you kept some, and what do they mean to you when you get them? Our number, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're celebrating letter writing today with Simon Garfield. His new book is To the Letter. And we want to hear from you. Our lines are full, but you can share your letter writing stories, whether you write letters, on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go back to the phones now. We have Marianne with us in La Crosse. Marianne, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I am just an avid letter writer, but I wanted to just share a story of what I gave to my niece one year in lieu of a Christmas gift. Her Christmas gift was a piece of mail that I would mail every day a letter to her for a year, the following year. And she was in another state. My mother had recently died, her grandmother. Both of us had a special relationship with her, and we were both grieving. And she was a young girl. I'm talking 80 years old about. And so I, in another state, would write her every day and send something. And I would tell her, just go to the mailbox, and you will know that every day I have thought of you. So I just wanted to mention that, that a letter can be a tremendous gift to the writer and to the recipient.
Wow.
That's all.
Thank you so much, Marianne. What a great story. Simon, giving the gift of letter writing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I get a thrill if I put something through a letterbox or through a postbox, and then I kind of know hopefully people will be happy to receive it as well. But I think that's a fantastic idea. I wish I had a relation like Marianne, is all I can say.
Well, thank you so much for that call. And let's go next to Paul, joining us from Iron River. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
What is your story?
The lady that just called on in, I couldn't agree with her more. And the other lady, just a few minutes ago, again, somebody that I identify very, very intently. I am an unapologetic letter writer. And in fact, about a year and a half ago, I completely, absolutely had the entire assemblies to the internet, including email, removed from my premises. I'll never go back to it. And the reason I did that, simply because, was the vain attempts at email communiques to me. They are invariably, they were obviously found to be constructed in a lazy manner, in a stultified manner. They were superficial, or as people of my generation used to refer to as plastic, fatuous, and any more, anyone would find them to be downright dangerous. I write letters, and very, very infrequently do I ever get a response, because I no longer have email. And to those people who don't respond to me with a letter, make a distant second attempt with a telephone call. Even that just does not have the effect. It does not have the panache.
All right. Well, thank you, Paul, for sharing your story. So Paul got rid of his internet. He won't do email anymore, and he's sticking to the letter. But is that a hard sell these days? He said he doesn't get many of them back. Do you think that's what happens these days when people write letters, or is there hope?
Well, as he says himself, you know, kind of a drastic measure, really. And I sympathize with him. I mean, I think in an ideal world, the two would happily coexist. You know, you would use email, but we would continue to write letters. I fear that Paul is in a minority, and it is very much a kind of age thing. I think if you've grown up with writing letters and you've been doing it all your life, then you'll continue to do so, and you appreciate the full value of what they can bring. But you know, I talk to my kids about it, and my kids are, you know, smart, intelligent, sociable people, I hope, and they're in their early 20s, and they appreciate the value of a letter, but they also say, well, you know, why should we do it? We communicate just the way we want to communicate with our friends, and we do a good job, and we get our message across. We meet up when we want to meet up, so they, it's the modern way of communicating, and I obviously think it's a great shame because they don't write in a long form. And I think it's going to be really a real shame for their kids because they're not going to find out, you know, find lovely caches of letters from them. But a slightly kind of scarier point, I think, is that we tend to, as your caller just did, you know, we tend to say, okay, letters are this and emails are this. And emails are now regarded very much as the, you know, the substitution for not writing letters, and people say, okay, well, at least we've got email. But the trend very much, and I know a lot of, you know, archivists and historians and people at public, you know, institutions will support this, is very much, you know, a feeling that the email is a passing phase, and the trend is very, very much towards just shorter transmissions. You know, it's text, and it's tweets, and that's the way it's going. And now young people regard email as too much effort. And that, as I said, I think is a you know, a really unnerving thought, that we won't really have any written record of you know, the way we live our lives going forward.
We'll go back to our callers now. We have Camille in Frankfurt. Camille, hi.
Hi. Speaking of lovely caches of letters, my sister and I recently had to go through my mother's house for all the personal correspondence and papers and everything, and discovered many letters written by grandparents and other relatives about family coming from Italy, and there was so much family history in there, little things and big things. And the fact is, if kids don't continue to learn to write and write letters, in a couple of generations, they're not going to be able to read handwritten letters either. And that would be an incredible loss when I think of what we just discovered. I even found a drawer full of all the letters I had ever written to my mom. And as I go through them, I see my life again. Mm-hmm. It's really an incredible thing.
Camille,
can't do that with email.
That's true. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Simon, that's one thing I worry about is, you know, our future family members, the genealogists and the social historians and biographers of the future, how important that is when we read about our past is maybe lost to future generations when they're looking back at us.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really, you know, the reason I kind of wrote the book, exactly that, to ask those questions. I mean, I know, you know, you know, the JFK anniversary is everywhere at the moment, and you know, we wouldn't know, you know, half of what we know about JFK and about the whole Kennedy dynasty without letters. I know there's a new book that's just appeared, you know, just with John Kennedy's letters in there. And that's, you know, that's a recent past, and all of that certainly applies to a past going further back than that. But the idea of sort of discovering things, I think, is so important as well. You know, as you say, both in terms of family history and then a kind of wider social history, and writing people's biographies as well. And it's something that we all know is happening, and we all know is true. And there's nothing really one can do about it other than say, hey, it's happening, and keep writing. But it's a hard sell, you know, I think.
Well, I want to ask you, I mean, do you think that the letter can be saved? I mean, here in the U.S., the USPS has had another year of billion-dollar losses, and it seems as though what you're saying is coming to pass, that the letter is going extinct. But are there any moves in the culture to support letter writers and encourage letter writing?
Well, the ironic thing, of course, is that the big movements, and there are quite a few, come online. If you do a Google search for kind of letter writing groups, letter writing campaigns, those kind of things, there are some fantastic organizations out there which are trying to encourage young people to write. There's one called moreloveletters.com and various others. I'll tell you a story. It's got so bad for me. I mean, I write some letters, and I get some letters back. Obviously, since I've been writing the book, I've written a lot more. But I also now pay to receive letters. There's a fantastic organization called Letters in the Mail that is run from a website called the Rampus. And for $5 a month, I get two letters in the mail, written by good writers, young novelists or teachers. And what happens is they write a letter, but they're quite intimate letters. They could be about, you know, their work or their relationship with their mother or, you know, anything like that. But it's quite serious things. And they're photocopied and then sent out to subscribers. So that's another way of people trying to keep the art alive.
I can't decide if that's awesome or sad.
I know. I feel that way as well. I feel happy though when I get the letters, because they are terrific things to read.
What is your, you know, in our last minute or so here, what is the most beautiful letter that you've ever gotten?
Oh gosh, I'm going to appear a bit slushy on you now, but I, you know, inevitably that would be a letter I received from my wife, and I think you know, hopefully. You know, the majority, if not all, of your listeners will kind of think back to, you know, an early relationship or an important relationship and think about the mail they've received, in those early days and hopefully still, you know, still have those letters as well.
All right. Well, Simon, thank you so much for being on and talking about letters with us today.
Well, I really enjoyed talking with you.
We've been talking to Simon Garfield, the author of To the Letter, a celebration of the lost art of letter writing.
A little while ago, I invited you to write letters to us here at Central Time. I was not joking. I am perfectly serious. Write us a letter. Get started on your letter writing career. Here's the address. Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. If we're not too flooded, maybe we can write you back, too.
All right, there's a project for us, and we'll maybe share some of what we read on the air if it's not too personal. I've gotten letters that I have saved to this day. One is from the author Vikram Seth. I keep it in
wow.
His beautiful handwriting. It came from London. It's beautiful. So we'd love to get letters from you. Let's keep it going.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll take a look at the origins of fracking in the United States and the rise of the industry. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.